This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
Good evening and welcome to the weekly checkup. We've become obsessed with doing more. More exercise, more work, more steps, more productivity, more everything. Somewhere along the way, we've convinced ourselves that if we're not exhausted, we're probably not trying hard enough. But what happens if the opposite is true? What if the real gains in health, fitness, and longevity don't happen when you're pushing yourself, but when we're recovering? That's why tonight we're talking about the science of recovery, sleep, stress, burnout, overtraining, and whether things like cold plungers, saunas, HRV tracking, and recovery therapies actually make a difference, or whether they are simply the latest health fad. So, if you've ever wondered why you're constantly tired despite trying to do all the right things, this conversation is for you. Dr. Anton Myberg, good evening. Hope you're well. You look tired.
Me tired? Never. Don't even mention that word. What is it? It's like a swear word.
I know. I get it. I really get it. So it's really such an interesting conversation because if I have to look at it like marketing, it's the white space. In other words, on a poster, you've got the active space, the words. What we're looking at is the white space, the space in between.
The space people don't generally understand.
Mm. And they're important.
Yeah, very important because it's very important to understand the actual processes behind how these things work.
So let's talk about what happens to the body during recovery.
So when your body goes into the recovery phase, you actually shift into a catabolism phase. So that's a catabolic phase, in other words. You break down tissue.
Never heard that word, actually.
What? Catabolism.
Yeah.
Catabolic. I'm sure you've heard anabolic and catabolic.
I know.
Obviously, you don't take steroids. Well, that's very much obvious. Okay. So anyway, when your body is recovering, you shift from this breaking down tissue to repairing and building tissue, which is anabolism.
Okay.
So these processes include things like muscle fiber repair through things called satellite cells. You get protein synthesis for growth, and you get things like glycogen replenishment for energy and a decrease in your body temperature and heart rate. And you have a few overlapping stages that occur in sort of a few hours. So you start off with what we call your immediate recovery phase, and that takes about 0 to 24 hours. So you have a waste removal phase where your body works to clear your metabolic byproducts, things like hydrogen ions and lactate, and restore your pH, your acidic balance in your body. Then you get something called vasodilatation and circulation. So your blood vessels stay dilated or widened to carry more heat away from the core and deliver fresh oxygen to your body. And you get fuel replenishment. So there your muscle cells begin taking up glucose and the fatty acids in order to rebuild these glycogen reserves and energy stores that you need. Overlapping that, you get an inflammatory response phase. And that's within 24 to 48 hours. So interestingly enough, during exercise, you get what we call micro tears. And these are microscopic damage that occurs to muscle fibers. That in turn causes an immune signaling. So your immune system responds to this by sending inflammatory cells and cytokines to these damaged areas and then removes the debris. So you get a controlled inflammatory response that clears away all the cellular debris, which is essential as the first step of new tissue to be laid down. And then after that, you get your repair and regeneration phase. And that's in like sort of 48 to 72 hours. So there you get your protein synthesis, where your muscle protein synthesis sparkens and allows your body to use your amino acids to fuse these damaged fibers back together. And you get these satellite cells, which fuse as well. And these cells will fuse your damaged fibers and causing building and thicker and stronger muscles to occur. And then you get tissue toughening. And that's when your connective tissues, your joints, and your ligaments go through a similar proliferation and repair phase to adapt to the stress. And then lastly, you get what we call a remodeling and growth phase, and that's in the last 72 hours. And there you get hypertrophy. Now, hypertrophy is what every bodybuilder wants. That's when your new muscle tissues are remodeled, and they become more efficient and larger to handle sort of a similar load in the future. And you get a super compensation phase where your body adapts to this exertion by exceeding its previous baseline, so temporarily storing more energy and function at a higher level. So in order to optimize all of these processes, your body relies on proper nutrition, like consuming the right amount of proteins and complex carbohydrates directly after a workout, as well as things like deep sleep, so your growth hormone and testosterone can release to a peak.
We are talking about recovery, why recovery is more important than people realize. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. Send us your questions, your comments, your thoughts, 061-895-1019. How important is recovery for you? How long do you take, do you generally take between a hard workout or a hard, difficult exercise regime? 061-895-1019.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. We're talking recovery tonight, and where we're up to is we've asked the question, what actually happens to the body during recovery? But what I want to know now is, following what you're saying, muscles seem to grow during rest and not exercise. Does that make sense?
That's a very good point, because the reason for this is because exercise, as you said, is what we call a destructive catabolic process. So this breaks down tissue, while rest is your constructive anabolic window. So that's when the body actually repairs and builds new muscle. So when you're doing a workout, your body prioritizes survival and energy output over tissue growth. And the growth only occurs when the physical stress stops. That allows your cellular and hormonal recovery and mechanisms to take over. So as we said, you get your cellular shift, which is your micro tears versus your protein synthesis. So during exercise, you do heavy lifting and resistance training, and that subjects your muscles to a high mechanical tension and to eccentric stress. This then forces those muscle fibers to experience that microscopic damage and tears. And then the body is then in a catabolic state. In other words, it's breaking down these molecules for energy. During rest, once that stress stops, your body then triggers something called the muscle protein synthesis. We call it MPS. And these specialized cells and fibers, those fibroblasts, they rush to these damaged areas to repair these microscopic tears. Now, the body then fuses the existing muscle fibers and then creates new muscle fibers and protein strands. And this overcompensation process makes your fibers thicker and more resilient and stronger than they were before, and allows the muscle to hypertrophy or grow as we know it.
So what we're talking about now is weights.
Well, weights and resistance, because during resistance you're doing the same thing.
Yes.
When you're putting tension,
but it's not
and
like something like running.
So running is a different type of thing. That's a different type of catabolic thing. You're also going to get micro tears in running.
Yes.
You know, you're also going to use different muscles, different organs for that type of exercise.
Okay,
but
it's
I
not
think what's very similar
this,
is that you do get a hormonal shift during this. So whether it's running or that type of thing. So in exercise, you release your stress hormones. We've spoken about it often, cortisol. And cortisol, we know, is a catabolic hormone, because that inhibits muscle growth to make sure your body's got enough glucose in the blood to sustain that physical exertion. But during sleep, when you're resting, that cortisol level drops. So during deep stages of sleep, you want that level to drop. And then your endocrine system releases huge amounts of growth hormone and testosterone. And these are your anabolic hormones.
Okay.
So those stimulate your cellular reproduction, accelerate tissue regeneration, and allow your amino acids to rebuild. And then, you know, during exercise, your body cannot multitask, because it's at a high level.
Excuse me?
Well, I don't know when the last time you did exercise. But anyway, what it does is it diverts blood flow and oxygen and nutrients away from your digestive tract, as well as your cellular repair system, to pump them directly into your working muscles and heart. So then your actual muscles deplete their primary fuel sources. So the glycogen, which is a stored carbohydrate, is depleted. So during rest, you have to replenish these muscle glycogen stores and then transport the amino acids to those damaged sites. And that's why it's so important to fuel yourself after you do exercise as well. You know, people always say you should have a protein or something before you do exercise. That's important. But after exercise, you've got to have your proteins in there to refuel your body so you can actually start sustaining yourself.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that. We'll get to that, because I definitely want to offer some guidance on that. Do you think that we've confused exhaustion with fitness?
Yeah, I think there's a misconception, because, you know, most people feel that if a workout doesn't leave you completely wiped out, then it's not effective. But, you know, I think sports science and research shows that exhaustion, where you actually deplete your and get neuromuscular breakdown, and fitness, which is different, that's capacity, endurance, and strength, are actually two different things.
Right.
So, you know, if you talk about the fitness industry, they glorify the term no pain, no gain.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
a huge mentality yes. in the fitness and that type of sort of culture.
Yes.
But there's a core difference. So fitness is built during recovery, where exhaustion is acute depletion. So when you work out, you create the potential for fitness. The actual adaptation of fitness, your muscle growth, your increased mitochondrial density, your cardiovascular efficiency, those happen when you rest, eat, and sleep. When you're exhausted, when you're feeling completely drained and sore unmotivated, that means you've actually created more fatigue than your body can currently absorb. And the confusion happens because it's this culture of toughness and this immediate gratification and this training addiction. You know, exercise triggers the release of dopamine and neurotransmitters. And, you know, you can't take a rest day because if you're passive, then you feel you're going to lose muscle training. So you've got to understand that you've got to know what the warning signs are of overtraining. If you've got decreased performance, if you've got persistent fatigue, severe body pain, increased resting heart rate, this is telling you that you're doing things wrong and you need to change things. So, the bottom line is that fitness should actually leave you more energetic, not chronically depleted.
So, in other words, that there's little doubt that in many ways people are pushing themselves
too
hard.
People are overtraining, yeah.
Okay. So
of course, present company excluded.
Why are so many successful people burnt out?
I think it's back to that culture. You know, it's a self-worth. You know, the self-worth is entirely tied to your professional output. So we get caught in the psychological trap where you continuously push past sustainable limits. And then it's not your problem is not that you've got a lack of talent or grit. Mm. It's an over-resilience of these habits that brought you success in the first place. So you've got things like perfectionism, hyper-responsibility, and you've got a relentlessness that leaves no room for physiological recovery. So you get what we call a high-functioning burnout. And that's what successful individuals often suffer from. So that's a state where you remain highly productive outwardly, but privately, you've drained your internal resources to zero. And, I mean, there's a whole thing. There's a dopamine trap where you actually, you know,
I just want to be clear on this. Are you referring specifically to exercise or lifestyle as well? Because
you asked me about successful people, you didn't ask me about successful exercise. We're not talking about exercise.
Because
here.
This is both.
This is more towards high functioning burnout from success,
right.
not
okay.
from overworking.
Success could be exercise, but it actually could be work.
It could be
career.
This is more like when you're reaching an existential crisis rather than a standard business hurdle type thing. You know,
right.
like
okay.
So you get a persistent stress activation, then you get that. As I was saying, you get this dopamine trap where you get massive waves of dopamine released and you want to try and hit those targets almost like you're addicted, like it's like a stimulant, like nicotine. You need more and more and more, and these high achievers become actually addicted to this baseline, and therefore they take more toxic workloads on just to feel like this sense of progression. So you've got to worry about the physical, mental, emotional sort of congruity of all these things on top of each other.
So that would obviously lead to chronic stress. That seems to be one of our biggest drivers of disease.
Yeah, for sure. Because
we've spoken about that a lot of times.
Fight or flight response. If that stays continuously switched on, then you get that resulting overproduction of cortisol, and that adrenaline is disrupted, and then you get nearly every major biological process is involved. So you essentially get a wear and tear of your long-term stress, and that can cause cardiovascular damage, because if you've got elevated adrenaline and you've got high cortisol levels, this can cause an increase in your blood pressure, that can damage your artery linings and increase your risk of heart disease. It can cause increased systemic inflammation. So cortisol at high levels will cause your immune system, and it prevents your immune system from down-regulating inflammatory responses. So it can be a catalyst for cancer progression, for inflammatory conditions like arthritis. And then once again, you get a metabolic disruption. So if you've got a chronic cortisol exposure, this promotes things like insulin resistance. Then that leads to the risk of developing type 2 diabetes, which leads to promoting visceral fat storage, so obesity and cardiac disease.
And that's how you get into that cycle. We do need to go to a break. Bianca, I see your comments. We'll come back to it. It is 18:20. I'm Howard Feldman talking to Dr. Anton Marburg. This is The Weekly Checkup.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This is the Weekly Checkup with me, Howard Feldman, and Dr. Anton Myberg. We're talking about recovery tonight. Bianca says, the only thing that makes me tired is when my hypoglycemia makes me tired, although sometimes it makes me hyperactive. I find going to the shops to buy food a workout because I've got to carry things up the stairs in shifts when I have to get into the apartment. So that does make me tired. So obviously this is part of that cycle.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you've got hypoglycemia, it's a whole different mechanism, because when you drop your blood sugar levels, you will be tired, you can get confused, you can get exhausted. So
look after yourself, Bianca. Keep up
your nutrition.
Yeah, exactly. We need you around. Let's talk about the nervous system.
Yeah, so that's very important, because essentially your nervous system is your body's master control. Now, we're speaking a lot about fight or flight, remember?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, your body shifts from that fight or flight into what we call a rest and digest state. So your nervous system will regulate your inflammation, your blood pressure, your hormone release in order to heal tissues. And you've got two primary pathways. And if these things are very familiar. You've got a sympathetic nervous system and you've got a parasympathetic nervous system. So your sympathetic nervous system is your body's accelerator. And that will activate during stress or triggering survival responses. And that causes increased heart rate and a lot of inflammation. Whereas your parasympathetic nervous system, this is almost the opposite. This is your body's brake, so it slows it down.
Mm.
And that's responsible for slowing down organ activity, so your body can actually repair the cells, it can process the nutrients, and it can recover properly. So when you're stressed or injured, your nervous system can actually become stuck in that survival mode. And in order to guarantee or facilitate genuine healing, you actually have to stimulate your parasympathetic branch to signal your brain that you are safe. And I mean, you know, you hear of these snipers that, you know, they go out and they've actually got to control their breathing. They have breathing to slow their heart rate down. That's a parasympathetic. They need to slow their heart rate down so they can focus and be sort of controlled when they shoot their guns. And they do what we call breath work and muscle relaxation in order to calm themselves down so they're not in that fight and flight situation.
Right.
So they signal their body
that they're not in that. So that's, you've spoken about chronic cortisol elevation.
Yeah.
Let's talk about recovery effects, the impact on hormones, inflammation, longevity.
So, you know, we're speaking about recovery. We're speaking about what we call prioritizing rest and regeneration. And that allows tissue repair, that allows the cells to clean up, and that ultimately optimizes your functional lifespan. So there's a huge connection between recovery and this long span. So your hormones and your tissues, they are balanced together. So when you have a recovery period, your body needs to synthesize the anabolic hormones. So these are like adequate rest conditions, and that will stimulate your production of things like testosterone and growth hormone. Now, these hormones are very important because they preserve your muscle mass, they support your bone density, and they prevent frailty. Whereas with cortisol management, you get a proper down regulation, which ensures that the cortisol, which is your primary stress hormone, needs to return to baseline.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to have that balance. So if you've got a chronic elevation in your cortisol, then once again, you'll drive that level, it'll push up insulin resistance and muscle breakdown and lead to a high propensity for diabetes. And we've spoken before about something called inflammaging. That's inflammation control. So that's when you've got unresolved chronic inflammation, and that becomes a primary driver of disease and cellular aging. So that's when you get from that sympathetic to the parasympathetic shift. So you get high stressful activities that trigger that sympathetic fight or flight situation. And then recovery will shift you into the parasympathetic rest and digest state. But the problem is that you're so much in that high stress activity, your body doesn't get enough time into that rest and digest.
You know, when we were younger, nobody spoke about inflammation.
No.
It like you were swollen or you weren't swollen.
You were just not allowed to swim for 30 minutes after you've eaten.
Yes, there was that. But seriously, inflammation wasn't a thing. Over the last number of years.
So over the last 10 years, inflammation has become a very big thing medically, because inflammation is not just a physical thing. It's a metabolic thing. So, you know, we'll go about things like GLP-1s, the new GLP-1s, target inflammatory responses in the body for cardiovascular disease, for metabolic disease, for gastrointestinal issues. A lot of our issues are inflammatory in nature. that we need to target, we call these so-called cytokine cells
can
and all these stressors.
Can you tell if somebody is suffering from inflammation?
So there are telltale signs.
Doctors are
like detectives.
Yeah.
You know, you always, when a patient walks into your office, you look at the way they walk, you look at the way they're looking, you look at their activity. You can already see an inflammatory state by certain telltale signs in their eyes, in the way their facial sort of expression is. It's probably like being a detective.
It's interesting because it's almost, is there a test for inflammation?
There's lots of tests for inflammation. So we look at things like something called an ESR, erythrocyte imitation rate, CRP, a C-reactive protein. Mm-hmm. Those are very good. And then we do a highly sensitive CRP in cardiac disease. There's things
so
like...
So that's why you'd need to know that, because for cardiac disease, you obviously that's critical because
it
means
you've got inflammation
you're
breaking down the enzymes in the heart. So you also look at enzymes in the heart. So
yes.
Inflammation, you know, sometimes people misconnect the dots with inflammation, because if you've got a high CRP, someone will think straight away you've got an infection, you've got a bacteria. We now have different criteria. We use something called a PCT, a procalcitonin, which helps you understand the difference between inflammation and sepsis. In other words, when you've got an infection in the blood.
One's an infection and one is
inflammation. And a lot of the time when you get a very high CRP and a very low PCT and there's no obvious signs of infection, you're not looking for an inflammatory response in the body. So someone who's got like rheumatoid arthritis, or someone who's got ulcerative colitis, or even someone with chronic deep vein thrombosis can present with a high CRP, but a very low PCT, and it doesn't mean they need antibiotics. It means they need to be looked at from a different angle. In fact, it happened to me a case this last weekend where that patient presented exactly with that, with a very high CRP and a very low PCT, and there was absolutely no signs of infection, and the CRP kept on going up, and we actually found deep vein thrombosis.
Wow. And science says, do adults have to exercise nearly every day? Well, I do exercise nearly every day.
Talking about adults.
I said, you know, nearly on a Monday, nearly on a Tuesday. Right, okay, but we will come back to that.
I don't know actually why I'm laughing at you. You worry me so much.
Okay, modern society, does it actually allow us to mentally recover? Because that to me has got to be so much part of it.
See, I think modern society is so overdeveloped for this continuous output and this creating constant state of hyper-arousal.
Because even when we're relaxing, we're looking at our watch. Am I relaxing? I'm not relaxing.
No. Well, it's like how many minutes until the fast is over? How many minutes until the Sabbath?
Have I relaxed
how many minutes
enough?
Until this? You're always on a time thing. So we've always got these boundaries over burnout. So, you know, we've got to recognize the difference between being physically inactive, such as like scrolling through the social media, doom scrolling, or giving your brain proper mental rest. And so in order to do that, you actually have to establish firm, non-negotiable disconnect times from screen. You know, take your family for a walk around the park without a phone, you know. You've got to understand there's a power in something called a small pause, where you actually take time out. So instead of waiting for a vacation, you know, make it happen, or turn your workspace into a quiet rest space, device-free, where your nervous system is not overstimulated.
Have you been to a radio station lately?
Well, you need professional support for
other
reasons.
Yeah, exactly. That is absolutely right. So, in other words, we're going to get to it, because we have to talk about recovery, because not only physical but also mental. Speaking of which, let's move on to that, and let's talk about sleep. You have sat here week after week after week, and you've spoken about exercise, nutrition, and sleep. Let's look at sleep. Is sleep the closest thing we have to a longevity drug?
So I have to say yes, and yes, and yes. It's probably one of the most powerful and easily accessible longevity interventions available. Because with a consistent high-quality night of rest, which doesn't happen to many people, you can slow biological aging, you can repair cellular damage, and you can prevent chronic diseases. Because during sleep, you get brain cleanup, you get cellular repair, you get a slowdown of biological aging, and you get disease prevention. And the sweet spot for sleep, the ideal window, is to get 7 to 8 hours a night, which will then offer the lowest mortality rate. Interesting enough, less than 6 hours or more than 9 hours is actually associated with accelerating aging or cognitive impairment and a high risk of heart disease. So everyone thinks the more sleep you get, the better. That is not true.
So anything 9 hours is already not okay.
So 7 to 8 hours, less than 6 or more than 9 is too much. And we're not talking about children who need
Or teenagers or whatever. Yeah. That's a different story. Can we bank our sleep? Can we catch up our sleep?
Can we never?
I think we can.
Okay, look at you.
Yes. Friday night, if I sleep for 9 hours, sometimes even 10 hours.
I'm just trying to set you 9 hours. It's not good for
you. Once a week, and then
slept,
we average it over.
Understood what I just told you now.
We average it over the week, and then I get up to
six. The only reason you sleep on a Friday night is because you can't go onto your phone. That's the only reason.
I don't think we need to make this personal. Really, really, I don't. Okay. What actually happens to the brain during sleep?
So, I think we've discussed it before, but you get the main phases of sleep are the deep sleep, which is your non-REM sleep, mm-hmm. your rapid eye movement, and your rapid eye movement sleep. So during your deep sleep, you get that waste clearance of that lymphatic system in the brain, and you get what we call memory consolidation. During the rapid eye movement, you get emotional processing and a physical sort of safety in the brain. The brain actually temporarily paralyzes your muscles to prevent you from acting out your dreams during that stage. And it's very important because inadequate sleep interrupts these crucial maintenance processes and restoration cycles in your brain. So that's why it's so important.
Right. And poor sleep, and we've said this before, linked to obesity, dementia, and heart disease. I have no doubt that the weight that I put on was largely because I sleep so little.
But that's why you don't put on weight on Shabbos, because you sleep so much.
Exactly.
But so obesity is very important, because what sleep does is it deprives you and it causes a hormonal imbalance with something called ghrelin. Now, ghrelin is your hunger hormone. And then it suppresses leptin. And that's a hormone that actually signals fullness. So it actually causes an increased caloric craving and a higher calorie intake.
Oh, that is so interesting.
So then it's
almost that satiety nerve.
It's a satiety cycle, basically.
Yes,
so that lowers your motivation to exercise.
Yes.
And then disturbs and impairs your resting metabolism.
Yeah.
And there's a higher propensity for dementia during this, because you don't get to clear the waste substances. So there's a higher thing for toxic metabolic products like that beta amyloid proteins. And then heart disease. Blood pressure normally drops, but if you're not sleeping well, it will go up.
I find that my lack of sleep makes people around me demented.
Yeah, I hear it.
But that's something maybe a bit different as well. Why are so many people sleeping badly despite being exhausted?
Well, I think there's a state we call wired but tired. That's exactly what's happened. So
wired but tired.
This is
like
because your nervous system gets stuck in that fight or flight mode. So you actually create a mismatch between your tired body and your overactive brain. So what happens is you get a stress and cortisol paradox. So your cortisol spikes, and under chronic stress, your brain is then constantly scanning, anticipating with elevating levels of cortisol, your stress hormone, even when you try and rest.
Mm.
So your stress hormone then triggers alertness, and that keeps the brain awake while your muscles are desperately requiring the sleep. And then you get what we call an emotional reactivity. So, which is quite ironic, because the exhaustion lessens the brain's ability to regulate emotions. Therefore, your daily worries become much more amplified at night time.
Oh, that is so interesting.
And then it also works as things like, you're suppressing your melatonin in your brain. So when you look at those electronic screens and those blue lights, they suppress melatonin. Now, melatonin is your hormone which is responsible for signaling your body that it's time to sleep. So that delays your sleep with this doom scrolling. And when your body should be winding down, it's actually getting cognitively stimulated. So we're getting these irregular schedules, and then people who nap for too long during the day reduce their sleep drive that is required for the nighttime as well. And then there's something which I don't believe in. It says I read about caffeine, but I will just ignore that,
nonsense.
You know.
Absolutely.
The other thing is late night eating. And I've said this many times, people who've got a propensity to eat a lot more at nighttime, generally those are people with sleep apnea, because what happens is your body has got a way to try and keep you awake at night. When you have sleep apnea, you don't realize that you're actually holding your breath and not sleeping well and doing deleterious effects to your body. So, some of the times you can actually hold your breath for 60 seconds. So what your body does is, I don't want you to go to sleep. I'm going to get you and send you down to the kitchen and make you eat more.
Yes.
And that's a very important sort of problem.
So, in fact, maybe our listeners will help, but I had a sleep specialist on the Morning Mayhem a few weeks ago, and he was speaking about a technique to help people fall asleep. And it's had such a cool name. I'm going to have to look it up. Unless somebody remembers on 061-895-1019, if they happen to be listening, where you go through the alphabet and you say, okay, A. Now you think of all these things and animals with an A. And it just takes your brain away from your worries so that it almost disassociates from it. I'd like to hear from you, 061-895-1019. What have you done lately to improve your sleep? Because we know how important sleep is. It has become absolutely, we now know it's critical. What have you done to improve your sleep? Do these wearable devices help?
So they don't directly improve sleep on their own, but they're very good and powerful behavioral tools. So they can help you spot patterns and adjust habits and recognize effects of caffeine timing or yes. evening exercise and help you. So it's almost like what we call behavioral nudging or nudging, okay?
Yes,
so
yes.
So many people can improve their perceived sleep quality by using these trackers because they tend to encourage better sleep times and better wind down times. And then when you get a points system like encouraging you to get more points because you sleep better, well, you know, it's a good thing. You know, you also look at things like health and recovery metrics, and we can speak about that through like a heart rate variation monitor and a respiratory target monitor. You know, these are very good things and these are very good targeted interventions to help you sleep. But at the end of the day, when you wake up in the morning, you know how you've slept, you know? And I think we've got it. There is a very important caveat here that there's an accuracy limitation with these things. So we know that they are good, but they aren't extremely precise at pinpointing specific sleep stages compared to when you go to, for instance, a medical in-lab sleep study. And then there's something called orthosomnia. And that's what a lot of people are doing these days. I'm sure you're an orthosomnic as well.
That's when
you constantly obsess over perfect sleep scores or metrics that can actually create anxiety and worsen things.
Yes.
Like all these people
because
who wear
when you worry, you worry about your sleep quality,
yeah.
Then
so these
it
lifestyle
gets worse.
Aids actually can make things a lot worse at times.
Right. It's called this technique is called cognitive shuffling, which actually really.
Sounds like a dance.
It does. Everyone is. No, that's something different. Okay. And you've spoken about deep sleep. I want to move on because I'm already aware I can't get over how quickly time does go. What about sleep and immunity? Mood, immunity.
So if you have sleep deprivation, then you're going to spark your cortisol and that will stall your recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So if you aren't sleeping, you aren't growing. And as I said, we need between 7 to 8 hours sleep a night, have good quality rest. Otherwise, your reaction time slow, your injury risk will go upwards, and then you crave those unhealthy, high-caloric foods. So it's called like a brain versus brawn type of situation because moderate exercise can help offset brain fog, okay, which is very important. And that can be caused by just one single night of bad sleep, whereas long-term sleep loss degrades your physical performance, power output, as well as cognitive functions. So, you know, there's a much higher propensity for injury due to a poor sleep because you significantly have a higher rate of actually getting injured because you don't focus as much.
Right.
And then you get hormonal hijacking, which is also an issue.
So, obviously, this comes from Unsigned, but Unsigned wonders if the good doctor practices what he preaches and wonders what time he went to sleep last night. I'm not saying who this is from, obviously.
So, you know,
but I do have the answer here in case you're thinking of.
So, that is a very good point because we all know that sleep does actually help with all these things. And, you know, if we lived in an ideal world, then we could do that.
100%.
The problem is that in the world we live in, when your phone rings at 3 o'clock in the morning to answer a call from ICU, that fragments your sleep.
And watching a series also, obviously, until 12:30 doesn't help either.
That would be a big problem if that were the issue.
If that were the case.
So we know that sleep is the answer to everything.
Right. It is 20 to 7. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your morning mayhem. You see, because I haven't had enough sleep, it's your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Talk to me about your sleep. 061-895-1019.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 1841. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. And Ada says reading definitely helps. I can tell you it helps me. But before we move on to, I wanted to ask you about all of these sleep devices. We'll just go through them very quickly. But just what exactly is HRV?
So that's one of the big buzzwords, okay? That's something called heart rate variability.
Right.
And that measures a tiny millisecond by millisecond fluctuation in your exact time intervals between your consecutive heartbeats. So in other words, when a heart rate of 60 beats per minute, that implies a beat every second. The reality is that the time between the beats varies. In other words, you can have 0.9 seconds between two beats and 1.15 seconds between others. So this natural irregularity is a sign of a healthy, adaptable cardiovascular system.
Okay.
So your heart rate variability is once again governed by what we call the autonomic nervous system, which is what we've spoken about, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. The parasympathetic is your rest and digest, and that tells your heart to slow down, which makes room for larger variations between the beats. And this results in a higher heart rate variability and indicates that your body is recovering. When you look at your sympathetic system, which is the fight or flight, that activates your stress or physical exertion, and that causes your heart to beat more consistently and limits the variation, and that results in a lower heart rate variability. So a higher heart rate variability suggests that your body is well-rested, highly resilient, and adapts well to stress. And that's a good sign of cardiovascular fitness. Whereas a low heart rate variability, that tells us your body's under physical or mental stress, and that can signify fatigue, overtraining, illness, or poor sleep.
So let's just before we look at these various items, Mark says, I put my head down and I'm gone almost immediately. However, I found the older I get, the less sleep I need. I'm 71. That's a thing, right?
Yeah. So as people get older, they do sleep less. And I mean, is it the right thing? Is the wrong thing? I'm not so sure.
Bianca says chamomile tea definitely helps me. And Adler says, I have bad dreams. Awful and active. Does that cancel out my sleep record? I sometimes think it's hardly worth going to sleep at all.
So, I mean, look, I mean, you know, are you having nightmares? Are you having night terrors? You know, the problem is that you still need the sleep. You still need the sleep to restore your metabolic.
So even if you're having those,
Bad dreams,
you're still sleeping.
You still need the sleep.
Right. Whoop.
Yeah.
I want to, Whoop, Oura Ring, Apple Watch, Garmin, sleep scores, recovery scores, Strava. I just wrote all of these things down. Talk to me about
that. So the Whoop is something that evaluates your daily physiological recovery and can give you actionable AI-driven data to optimize your sleep and detect early warning signals, signs of illness, and prolonged health span. So it gives you continuous monitoring where it tracks round-the-clock blood oxygen levels, skin temperature, sleep architecture. It can look for things like atrial fibrillation and give you a recovery scoring. And recovery scoring is you actually calculate a daily recovery score from 0 to 100% by measuring your autonomic nervous system, and that helps you adapt to physical strain.
Okay, and just going through, because I want to move on to things like saunas, cold plunges.
So if you go quickly, like the Oura Ring, the Oura Ring tracks like different metrics, and it looks at your sleep stages, your heart rate variability. They're all very similar. They can help with early illness detection, stress
and
recovery.
Are they worth it?
They are worth it.
Okay.
You know, they are worth it, but as long as you don't get that sort of paranoia that you can't sleep because of it.
Data obsession, I think it is.
Yeah.
Right, so saunas, cold exposure, and modern recovery trends. Let's start with saunas and cold plungers. Are they truly beneficial, or are they just social media hype?
So they actually do offer genuine physiological benefits.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that social media puts them into miracle cure categories, and that's not the truth, okay? There are extremely healthy benefits from using saunas. Those are actually the more and the most heavily researched proven of the two therapies when you're looking at saunas and cold plungers. So a lot of the studies show that if you use the sauna frequently, like 4 to 7 times a week, that's actually associated with a significant reduction in cardiac death and all-cause mortality, okay? Heat shock proteins, that's an intense heat that induces release of proteins that help in cellular repair and systemic inflammation. And that heat acts as actually a time-limited antidepressant because it relaxes the body and produces cortisol.
That's fascinating. And
cold plunges, yeah, cold plunges. Contrast to that. So those are highly effective for specific goals, but they don't cure obesity, and, you know, the overall cure-all is overblown. So they do help with muscle soreness, you know.
But you're saying that if you had to choose between the two...
If I had to choose, I'd go for the sauna.
From a health perspective, go for the sauna.
The cold plunge will reduce inflammation, accelerate recovery,
help
with mood injury. Yeah. But, I mean, if you plunge yourself into a cold bath immediately after a resistant workout, first of all, you can blunt the long-term muscle growth and as well have a heart attack if you've got cardiovascular disease.
So this is what my late father always used to say. He used to get into the pool. Well, before he got into the pool, he would tunk, and then he would wet things in his heart. And people were nervous about that. I didn't know if that was real. Clearly it is. What is cryotherapy?
So cryotherapy is a new thing I've actually come on to now, which is very good.
Have you tried it?
I've tried it. I tried it in the last 2 weeks. And I like trying these things, and I think it's fantastic. Okay.
What is it?
So cryotherapy offers benefits to pain relief.
Wait. What is it?
So basically you go into this room.
Yes.
At subhuman temperatures of minus 75 degrees.
Jesus.
And it blows cold ice onto you. So you're actually basically standing in your underwear.
We Jews, suffered enough.
You're basically like in a pogrom.
You stand in Siberia in your underwear, effectively.
It is fantastic. So you stand there for 4 minutes, and you come out of there, and you feel
revitalized. What are your feet on? What do you mean?
So you stand, I'm not going to tell you stand in Crocs, because that would really freak you out.
No, I would never do it.
But there's so much science backed by this. Like, you come there, you get pain and joint relief. It causes muscle health and energy.
It's so interesting.
It causes skin health, you know.
So you just stand there for 4 minutes in these minimum temperatures.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal. So you do get cold,
won't it? Of course.
But you come out of there, and it's almost like a fight and flight reaction, because when you're in that temperature, your body pushes all the blood to the organs that need it the most. And when you come out, you get that blood flow going to other areas. So you get a detoxing of your whole body. And it's very good for you for your muscles and all that type of thing. And it regulates your whole body. But once again, you shouldn't be doing it after a massive workout.
And you've done both cold plunging and cryotherapy.
Yeah, and I far more enjoy cryotherapy than cold plunging.
Interesting that. Yeah, okay. We've spoken about heat exposure. Can discomfort actually improve your mental health?
So the answer, funnily enough, is yes. Because if you've got discomfort, it's actually a catalyst for your mental growth. So if you step out of your comfort zone, what does that do? It helps you build emotional resilience. So then you get to rewire these neural pathways in your brain through that process we discussed before, neuroplasticity. And then that causes behavioral changes. So if you avoid these feelings like frequently, then you get locked up in these unhealthy patterns. So it can trigger your growth signals. It causes positive stress. It's a very good thing for you.
Breath work.
Breath work has got many, many benefits in the medical field, from calming down your sympathetic system.
Is this whole square breathing business?
So it's actually a conscious regulation of your breathing patterns, and that optimizes your mental and physical well-being. And it shifts your nervous system out of that fight or flight mode, and it reduces your stress. So breathwork is excellent. You call what's called box breathing.
I have you to. Yes, yes, yes. That was the one.
Yes. That's one of the most common techniques they use. And you inhale for 4 seconds, then you hold out for 4 seconds. Then you hold your breath. So inhale, hold your breath for 4 seconds in, exhale for 4 seconds, and then you hold and empty for 4 seconds. And, I mean, that is exceptional breath work to help you with your parasympathetic system.
I mean, I find the stuff eye roll worthy, but the truth is I had to have surgery. I was in a lot of pain, and my wife said, do square breathing. I don't know what that was, and she told me, and it helped.
Like you didn't start the foxtrot.
Well, exactly. Okay, we're going to be back straight after this. 061-895-1019. I'm Howard Feldman.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
1851, I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. Anton L. says, I'm feeling exhausted today, so I'm taking leave tomorrow. Was so tired I couldn't bring myself to hear the stats of the show. Actually, too much Chai is exhausting. You don't need to tell me about that. Okay, so overtraining.
So that actually happens when you do intense training, and that is when you outpace your body's ability to recover. So that can cause a prolonged decline in your physical performance. Chronic fatigue can cause neurological and hormonal imbalances. It's not a normal temporary workout fatigue. And that's from excessive training loads, high intensity training, and of things like poor sleep. So you'll notice that overtraining causes a sustained drop in your performance. It will cause a persistently elevated high heart rate, chronic muscle soreness, and mental and emotional abnormalities and uncharacteristic mood changes. So obviously you've got to fuel your body, get enough sleep, build in designated rest days, and vary your routines.
Okay, and is this a real thing, this adrenal fatigue? Does it exist?
So, you know, when you get physical symptoms of extreme exhaustion and burnout, they are very real. But adrenal fatigue itself is a medical myth. The adrenal glands do not simply burn out from stress. So the foundation of this is that chronic stress will overwhelm your adrenal glands, cause them to underproduce hormones like cortisol over time. So the adrenals don't tire out, but when your body's under stress, your adrenal glands actually produce more cortisol, not less. And, you know, there are potentially harmful treatments. So people take these unprescribed adrenal supplements, which can sometimes actually contain steroids or thyroid hormones, right, and that actually inhibits your body's natural adrenal function or delays the diagnosis in real life. And the reality of what's happening is that when these symptoms are commonly labeled as adrenal fatigue, it's things like persistent exhaustion, brain fog, difficulty sleeping, mood swings, they are real symptoms, but they come from different medically recognized conditions. So if you've got something called your hypothalamic pituitary axis in the brain, and that's a complex sort of network between your brain and your endocrine system, this can get disrupted by psychological or physiological stress. That will throw your body's whole hormonal and circadian rhythm out of sync. There are other medical conditions that can cause that to happen, such as sleep apnea, depression,
adrenal disease, like Addison's disease.
These can cause that.
I want to just, because we've literally got about 2 minutes left, I want to ask you about supplements. And there's magnesium glycinate, there's creatine, there's the thing, there's that NAD, there's MOTSI, there's so many that we are hearing about, and spend any time on social media and they'll tell you you pretty much have to take them. Now, I've started taking magnesium glycinate, and I can tell you it's made a massive difference to my sleep.
So I love magnesium glycinate.
Yeah, me too.
It's a highly bioavailable compound. It's a very popular form of magnesium, because what they do is they pair magnesium with glycine, which is an amino acid, and that amplifies the absorption and it delivers a gentle calming effect on your gut. So it helps with muscle relaxation, it helps with lactic acid clearance, and it helps with sleep optimization. It also helps with anxiety and stress. So
Interesting. I find it incredible. I love 30 minutes before sleep. Yeah.
Creatine is unbelievable. I think every adult should be on creatine as long as they're drinking enough fluids with it. It helps with your building of your protein synthesis, with muscle building, with Alzheimer's, with dementia. It's a winner.
And ashwagandha, anything?
I think what you're terming is ashwagandha.
Yes, so that's the one.
Ashwagandha is actually used for stress resilience and what we call cellular vitality. So remember, we've spoken about inflammaging. That's where you've got these high levels of cortisol. And what happens is this ashwagandha has got a role in recovery and longevity. So it actually combats that inflammaging. So it helps lower your inflammatory markers like your CRP and your oxidative stress. It works with cellular and brain health. It helps with hormonal regulation. It modulates that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. It helps with sleep optimization, and it helps with cognitive processing. So I've got a big thumbs up for that. But obviously, you've got to know that people with organ transplants or people who are taking insulin or immune suppressants should be aware
just
of these things.
Just make sure that you know what you're taking. Yeah. NAD, MOTSI, SS31.
I love those. You know,
peptides.
NAD is actually not a peptide. NAD is an enzyme. It's a coenzyme, right, which is for cellular energy production. But I'll speak about MOTSI and SS31 first, because we normally pair them all together. So MOTSI is working with your mitochondria, and SS31 binds to the cardiolipin, which is a lipid, a peptide, binds to that in the mitochondrial membrane. And these actually repair existing damage and drives metabolic activation, increases energy levels from what your mitochondria need. When you pair that together with NAD, which is nicotinamide adenosine dinucleotide, then That's a critical coenzyme for cellular energy production. That helps with DNA repair. That helps things called sirtuin activation, so with your telomerase and shortening of your DNA. And it boosts your longevity. It helps cellular repair. It helps with energy production. So MOTC, SS31, plus NAD are unbelievable things for energy production.
We are out of time. And Moshe, I'm sorry I'm not coming to yours. Bianca, not going to get to yours either. Dr. Anton Marburg, thank you. As always, next week, we are talking about the skin. We're talking about melanomas. We're talking about aging. We're talking about all sorts of things with the skin. Craig, thank you for staying late. Thank you for keeping us on the straight and narrow. We'll be back with you for the weekly checkup next week. Same time, same place.